Boothroyd, and he is the chair of the Law and Policy.
Mental health law and policy.
So, would you say that? Just say it.
Yeah. I'm chair of the Department of Mental Health Law and Policy at the University of South Florida. I'm not Mary Armstrong.
Okay.
So, and Mary sends her regrets. So she really wanted to be here, but is dealing with a little family issue. We have no financial or commercial disclosures to tell you about. I always get interested when I see this because for those of you who know us, Mary and I are married, so we do have a relationship, but it's not financial or commercial. I'd like to acknowledge that the original research was funded by a grant from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, as well as a contract that we have with the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration. So some background, and this is very consistent with what Mary Jane presented. So we know from the SAMHSA survey that each year about 20% of adults have experienced some type of a mental health problem, and that 30 to 40% of those, depending upon what study you look at, do not receive any mental health services. And of those that receive services, the majority of them only receive one type of care. So there is some sort of service gap that exists in terms of the use of mental health services for those who presumably are in need of those services. Now, if we look at the literature on service utilization, there's a number of reasons that have been highlighted and presented in the past. And one sort of classification of reasons that have been talked about in the literature are what are called attitudinal barriers. And those are individuals who think that they can manage their own symptoms or that the problem will get better by itself. There are probably the ones that we more commonly think of, classified as sort of structural barriers. These are things related to the availability of services, not knowing where to go for services or how to sign up for services, affordability, so insurance and co-pays and all those kinds of things, accessibility, trying to get an appointment, wait times, all of those kinds of things, location, how far you have to go, and then the acceptability of services. So, and stigma would fall into that and being afraid that people will know that you're going to receive mental health services. So those are some of the reasons that have been listed in the literature in terms of why people don't use mental health services. So this was actually a secondary qualitative analysis to explore, once again, some of the reasons why adults with severe mental illness were not using mental health services. And the data source was actually a project that we did, and it's quite old. It was finished in 2000, so it's old data. And like a lot of projects, we collect lots of data, and we never really fully analyzed it. So we actually dug it out and went back and did a reanalysis, or Mary did most of the reanalysis. So we had some narrative responses to two basic questions around service utilization that we interviewed people who had not used services during the course of the study that we were looking at. And this was a study really focused on the use of managed mental health care. So the two questions related to, the first one related really to the reasons why people, at least once again, were all adults with severe mental illness, were not using mental health services. And then the second question related to, from their perspective, what kinds of things, what kind of changes to the mental health system might increase the likelihood of their utilization of mental health services. As I mentioned before, these were all adults, and adults were actually operationalized as 21 to 65. They were living in the community. They were all receiving supplemental security income because of their mental health condition. And because of that, they were all enrolled in the Florida Medicaid system, so they did have access to care. In terms of the demographics of the 83 people that were interviewed, they're in their mid-40s. They were primarily women, and that's sort of interesting because the study itself had primarily men in it. In terms of race ethnicity, about 57% white, 30% black African-American, and about 12% Hispanic. So at the third wave of data collection for this managed care study, we had 542 people that were interviewed. And of those, 102 had not used any services over the 14-month span that they had participated in that study. And once again, these were all adults receiving supplemental security income because of their a mental health condition. So that comes out roughly to 20%. I thought that was high, actually, with 44% in New York. I don't think of Florida as doing a good job lots of times, but I actually feel pretty good about that. So you actually changed my thinking on that, Mary Jane. This is a sort of a digression, this next one, but it was interesting since this was a study of managed care. If you look at the rates of non-use based on the type of health care plan they were in, the individuals who were enrolled in a health maintenance organization, 24% of them did not use any services. It was 13% for people in fee-for-service system, so almost half, and then 17% for those that were in a mental health carve-out. So there was variability depending upon, even though these were all Medicaid-funded services, there was certainly variability in terms of the likelihood of using services. So in terms of the first question, this is the question about what reasons do people cite in terms of not using mental health services. Four major themes emerged. The first one had to do with mental health services were perceived as not being needed. The second theme was accessibility. The third theme was previous mental health services were used, but then they were not found to be very helpful. And the last major theme that emerged out from that question was that they were using primary care physicians to receive that. So they stayed on the medical side for their mental health care. If we unpack those a little bit, the first one, the mental health services perceived as not needed, 37% of the 83 respondents made some comments about that. And here are a few of the quotes. So I'm 66 years old and I know that I am depressed, but I can take care of myself. Or finding some alternatives. The church has worked for me in my life and my mental health care is not necessary. So this belief by respondents that they didn't need services or could find some informal supports to meet what needs they thought they had. In terms of the second theme for this first question, accessibility, about 25% of the respondents had some comments that related to this. And this, there were a variety of reasons around access. So transportation, which we hear over and over again. Mental health care is so inconvenient. You have to wait long times to get into a facility. Orientation, we had a lot of facilities you had to wait to go to orientation, and it was 6 or 8 weeks, and then you had to sit through 2 hours about what their expectations were for you. And then a third one here, I could not keep the doctor I wanted because of Medicaid changes. So that was related really to this implementation of the mental health managed care in Florida. Previous mental health services perceived as not helpful. That includes dissatisfaction with medication. So here's some quotes. When you get in it, it's not quality care, so I don't go. So this perception that even when you do engage in services, it doesn't meet one's needs. I prefer not to go to the doctor because the medicine makes me feel worse. I can do better on my own without medication. We have a lot of consumers, obviously, that have this belief structure. They don't want to be loaded with medications. Certainly, we should understand that. And they want alternatives to that. And to the extent that those alternatives are not available in terms of more one-on-one therapies or talk therapies or other alternative services, for some groups of individuals, that is an issue that will make them discontinue care. And then the use of primary care as a mental health provider. We had 11% of the participants that were receiving care, but it didn't show up in the mental health sector because they were receiving it through their primary care. I'm happy with my doctor of physical health who just prescribed me medicine. So here's someone, and this is why we need choice for people, who the medication was working for them. And they could get it through their primary care doctor, and that was sufficient. In terms of question two, and once again, this was the question that related to what changes would you recommend or what changes might influence or increase the likelihood of you going to receive care? Five major themes emerged. Access was there, once again, talked about. Distrust in the mental health system was a second theme. Lack of empathy by clinicians. Cultural and linguistic competence. And then continuity of care. So those were the five themes, and we'll run through those one at a time. Access had a lot of components to it. So location was one. 51%, by the way, 51% of the respondents, those 83 respondents, had some component of access as an issue in terms of getting it. So location was one. Sometimes worrying about how you're going to get to the psychiatrist is more stressful than the appointment itself. So the challenge, Florida has very poor public transportation, and what transportation there is expensive. You know, getting to clinics or wherever the service is being provided can sometimes be literally hours on the bus, number of changes and stuff like that. Availability of counseling services rather than psychotropic medications. I alluded to this related to the first question. And this is the notion that people want enough time for counseling. They don't just want to be given prescriptions. There are other things that they want to talk about. So this notion of one-on-one providing more time was an issue of access that people talked about. Choice. So a lot of consumers noted they wanted choice about who, where, and what related to their mental health care. So a few examples, quotes, I would like to have options in who I can see. So choice in terms of the type of person that they're seeing. Give me more than one option of places to receive treatment, that reverts more to the location kind of thing. I would like to see more groups. They help me, and I am looking into it. It will probably go to one soon. So they're trying, they like group situations. Now, if that was me, that I don't like groups, so I probably wouldn't opt for something like that. But once again, the importance of providing choice for people, which is exactly what that component of access was. And then information came out as sort of a need. Oftentimes, people don't know how to sign up or where to go or what service options are available. So this quote, make it easier to find answers about who to call, where to go for help with mental health, and different offices that people need to answer questions. Lots of times if you call the help number, you get transferred three or four times. We make it very challenging sometimes for people to get what should seemingly be pretty simple and straightforward answers to where to go, how to gain access, and those kinds of things. And these, once again, were folks that were already in the Medicaid system. So they were already there. So you can imagine what it's like if you're not even in the system. In terms of themes 2 and 3 for this second question, we talked about this notion of distrust in the mental health system. But almost 1 in 5 people mentioned that as a reason for their non-use of mental health services. And in terms of how to fix it, they said they don't think there's anything. I have no confidence that the system will really change. So we got some work to do with some folks in terms of trying to get them to re-engage, but that will only happen if, in fact, we can demonstrate we've changed our behavior and are more responsive to their needs. And then lack of empathy by clinicians. We had 15%, 14% of the respondents that mentioned that. Request more helping behaviors, personal involvement. So the quote here is, I would like to see more compassion in the mental health system instead of just putting Band-Aids on the problem, find the root problem. And those kinds of things take time, and they're not fixed with a prescription. And the last two themes for the second question, cultural and linguistic competence. We had 5% of the individuals that said that. These respondents were primarily Hispanic. Okay, we had about 12% of the individuals who weren't using services that were Latino and Spanish-speaking clinicians. I mean, if you live in Florida, you would think that we would have a pretty good access to bilingual clinicians and practitioners. And continuity of care, 5% of the consumers mentioned that. Consumer requested few changes. And once again, I'll put this may have emerged because of what was happening in Florida at the time we did the study with sort of the implementation of managed mental health care, and it required a number of people to change plans and stuff like that. We're going through another major revision next year, and all of the folks that are in the mental health carve-outs will have to move to different plans. So we're going to actually, that continuity of care question's going to be a big one for us in Florida going forward. So, if we look at the findings, I think they're very consistent with what's in the literature. Consumer perceptions include both these structural kinds of things, the access, the affordability, the acceptability, those 4 A's. The barriers of affordability didn't really emerge in this, and it's not surprising that it really didn't emerge, right? These were all folks who had insurance and were enrolled in the system. So the barriers for them were more about, once you're in, how does the system work? Access to care should be still a primary concern. Obviously, we get the Affordable Care Act. We talk about more integrated health care. I put health with a big H to include oral health care, physical health care, substance abuse. And I think some of the success of this, if we get the website working, will be how well we do in terms of dealing with some of these access issues for folks. There's, I think, real potential, but there's also the potential for real challenges. And lastly, the emphasis on the Affordable Care Act on integrated physical behavioral health care. We need to better educate folks and primary care physicians on mental health so they can particularly if we have folks who will be providing mental health care on assessment, treatment, and referral to more specialty services. So the references, and that's Mary's contact information. Once again, she sends her regrets. So, any questions? I can try and answer. Yes?
Speaking from the primary care safety net angle, I agree that we need better screening tools. Do you think that the mini metal screen would be appropriate in a primary care setting and as a tool for what can we take care of ourselves or what do we have to send out?
I think it certainly could be. There's a number of, I think, some tools out there. Dave Shuren and his group out in Colorado, Gene, right, you probably did some work at Nita Cohen. They developed a measure a long time ago. We've used a lot, the Colorado Symptom Index. That's been used as sort of a brief screen. We've done some work since David was dean of our institute for a long time. We did some work in terms of some psychometric properties there. I think there's a number of very simple self-report screens. They do tend to have false positives associated with them, but for an initial screening to identify individuals who may need more detailed screening, I think there's a number of good things, and it looks like the mini minnow might be a good one.
Modified mini.
You want to comment? Yeah.
One of the nice things about the MMS is that it hits a wide range of people, so pick up depression, anxiety, and psychosis. some screens developed within the specialty sector really do focus on people using specialty sector services. So I think in primary care settings, you do want something sold broader. The MMS is really good. There are a number of screens that pick up depression primarily, like PHQ-9.
Mm-hmm.
And as I showed you in this OCHDOT study and also in our chemical dependency studies, anxiety is a big deal out there. It's one of the most prevalent conditions in the National Comorbidity Survey. So I think you do want to pick up anxiety. I don't think you want to focus on depression. And the CSI is good, focuses on psychosis, really. So I think it's kind of a vanilla screen. 22 items, yes, no, add them up, got some to see. Okay. It's pretty good. I'd be happy to show my partners if you want to ask us more about it. We have a publication. It was 2008 that describes it in the chemical dependency arena, that first study. We'll publish this soon.
Can you all hear?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's open it up then to questions for anybody on the panel. We have a few more minutes. So other questions, not just with Roger. I know there were some questions early on.
Well, I mean, stigma is actually an important role. People are afraid. There are costs associated with stigma, right? It could have economic costs associated with stigma. People may not hire you because of a mental health problem. So, we don't talk about it. We got a lot of work to do in that area. It's not my area of expertise. You probably have done.
I think what was really good here when we're talking about how are we going to change the system to better either screen people so we know what they're dealing with or or how they're going to experience it. We've got to talk with the client. We just have to talk with them to understand some of those barriers. And
I know that there's been efforts to do sort of school-based screening, and it's very controversial, even on a voluntary basis, because if you, for a couple of reasons, I think, but primarily because if you identify at a young age, youth or children who may have some mental health needs, it puts a label on them, and we're very, very concerned about that. Then there's the whole issue about what are we going to do because we don't have the service capacity to provide the care. But with all of the problems that have gone on nationally that have evolved a mental health component, at some point we're going to have to get over this hump, I think, in terms of just moving forward. Yes?
One comment, and then I'm curious. So here, last year we had Bernice Tesla-Toledo talk, and her work on stigma is really, really good. So I just would suggest you look at that. And I'm old, so I thought we'd be done with stigma. And still just here, so look into that. No.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all the work that you've done, and I love the public who has set up from the measurement to the actually the person's perspective. The part that you actually just spoke about with regard to the healthcare and mental health coming together, part of the issue has been that physicians are not trained and they don't want to open up Pandora's box because they're responsible. Because there's not enough resources in the community to get to them. Is anybody that you know of looking at that evaluation of the experience of the primary care and the person-centered medical home with this integration process?
Yeah. I don't know of anybody that's doing it currently. I can tell you, when I first went to work for the New York State Office of Mental Health many, many years ago, I was hired because the New York State Office of Mental Health put a lot of money into a family practice residency program. And the program was designed to really enhance sort of the behavioral health training of these family practice physicians. So I did that evaluation, and when we looked at things like how they performed on standardized tests in terms of their knowledge of behavioral health issues, very, very high. I did a follow-up study of that after they had graduated or out practicing. Went out and interviewed them. It was great fun. None of them were really doing anything in the area of behavioral health, and it was because of the financing. Because they had to produce so much revenue. And there's no mechanism for primary care doctors or family practice doctors to spend lots of time, to sort of do the assessment and stuff like that. So, in that case, it was a fiscal issue.
Yeah, I know in Colorado, we're really trying to train our residents, but then I don't think we've done any follow-up to see what actually happens when they get out there.
It'll be interesting. They're trying to get more ACGME and trying to get more of the medical residents into the community-based center. If that happens, it would be great to see how we can integrate the health screening with the experience of professionals, interprofessionals, which is another push, to be able to do that. I think that would be fascinating to get to look at that.
In our study, we have the medical assistants do the assessments. Because that, they have more time, or they're cheaper to pay them, and the doctors don't have all that much time. And we use a PHQ-9, and which I know is narrow to depression. And so I'm interested, Dr. Alexander mentioned that the MHRM could be used to follow outcomes over time, and that's how we've used the PHQ-9 for that. Are they getting better on the therapy we're using? How about the mini metal screen? Would that be a way of following therapeutic outcomes?
No.
It's a good pickup. Need treatment or not? It doesn't improve.
I would not use that as an outcome. I think it focuses on symptoms, which is not bad. Current symptoms. I would not use it as an overtime one. I would not. I don't know what it is. I'll tell you, it seems to me often that what you want to look at is outcomes over time. You do want to look at whether you're being effective with the folks you stay, but I often look at statewide data sets on, I look at the whole chemical dependency treatment or system, the whole mental health system. And engagement and retention and treatment would be a pretty good thing to focus on as outcomes of care. I mean, people peel hugely. I think people peel because the reasons they're rushed is not just that they don't go to the front door. People get into the front door and they're gone. People are not staying for more than 90 days in treatment, 60 days in treatment. So I think the big quality improvement effort would be to, once you're inside the system, is to see what is it that's making people just not want to use our services. Coercion, stigma, feeling that the quality of care, is it concerned about what the quality of care is? I think those are big education issues and consumer rights issues. So I guess that's not a straight answer to your question, but I don't think screening symptom items are really good monitors.
Question. Yeah, I have two questions for Mr. Young. If I'm interested in validating a recovery or mental health recovery instrument in a population in which mental health recovery concept is almost absent, so I'm from Romania, we don't have mental health recovery centers or instruments to assess mental health recovery. I have two questions related to this. What scale do you recommend me to use in order to validate the mental health recovery scale, and how can I select my population?
Will you repeat the question?
Right, sure. So the question is how to validate or how to use the mental health recovery measure in a system that's not doesn't have a strong history of recovery orientation.
Yes.
And I think it's an excellent question. I think when you're thinking about recovery orientation, moving systems towards recovery, you want to think about both kind of the structure of care, what services you have, what providers you have, and then what the outcomes are that you want and how you want to move things. So there have been actually some good work on the workforce needed for recovery. I did a study, and for instance, with Ed Knight and some others, the self-defining competencies that providers need to have. So you can actually measure, there are scales, we had developed a competency assessment instrument. You can measure the competency of your providers around recovery. So do they know what recovery is? Do they have an approach that adheres towards recovery? And then you can think about what services and so forth. And then I think in terms of, I think it's helpful to also think about where your providers are at and what kind of education you might need or what type of interventions in terms of working with consumers or getting people to think in a more recovery-oriented direction as opposed to just sort of hospitalizing or institutionalizing people. And then what services or supports might be necessary for that. And then I think when you're following people over time, it's the recovery, like the MHRM that we had is a good one. And then it's also good to have, so it's been discussion here of sort of symptom measures to follow over time. So if you want to, if you're working with someone in depression, the PHQ 9 is a good measure over time. If you're working with someone in like an anxiety disorder, there are screening instruments. There are instruments that measure sort of severity of anxiety depending on what the anxiety disorder is, or there are measures, there are instruments that measure psychosis severity. It can be done with other instruments like the BASIS is a very good measure for, which has been validated by NIMH. The BASIS 24 were used over time in a number of different symptomatic and sort of domains. And then there are also sort of functioning measures. The WHO-DAS is the functioning measure that's currently advocated by the American Psychiatric Association, for example. The GAS score, the functioning measure that I presented here, is gone. The current new version of the DSM has the World Health Organization functioning measure, which is a perfectly reasonable one. There are other ones, such as mental health, the MOS, thank you, I'm trying to think about calling it the SF, whatever. It's not the SF, the MSF12/mental health, MOS survey for cost-related or mental health, physical health functioning outcomes, calculated quality of life, and then there are a number of other instruments like that. So I think it's but the whole idea of having actually an approach where you start to measure these things and start to think about them and then work with clinicians and services and overcome the ideas that these things are sort of impossible. And so we've had, for instance, I worked with a night who brought consumers and did education with it, who's a consumer leader, and consumers or peers in or people in who have experience with moving systems toward recovery, which can also be helpful.
It's a good question. I think in terms of the cultural content, there's be a whole lot of more instruction to have, but once you look at each scale. Yeah, one more question.
Oh, this is a general question for anybody. I'm curious what any of you think of the quality of care being a result of maybe sometimes being overambitious without the funding to be so ambitious. I work with outpatient mentally ill brain injury patients, and one of the things I've noticed is that people have this idea where we want to take in as many people as we can and help as many people as we can, but as you do that, there's a lot of hands that are involved in any mental health situation. It's not just therapists, it's psychiatrists, social workers. And as you try to bring more people, the care for each individual becomes a little less personalized, and the communication lines kind of break down some. And I'm curious if you think that, maybe we need more funding before we can do anything, or maybe we have to keep our ambitions a little smaller, at least within individual programs, because when you think too big without the right funding, then the quality of care falls a little bit short. And, you know, I work with clients, and as time goes on and as they expand the program, you see that there's less personalized care. And as a result, people become more frustrated with the system because they think these people don't care about me. These people, they're worried about making money or they're worried about their business and their company. But as you talk to people within the ranks of the company or within the ranks of the people trying to help, they're saying, oh, well, we just want to help as many people as possible, so we're taking more people. And I wonder how much you think, I know that's a very broad question, but I wonder how much you think that's part of the problem.
I was just going to say, I know in Florida, I have safety net providers, so the services that are funded out of state general revenue dollars for individuals that don't have health care coverage and stuff like that are real challenge. And with things like the Affordable Care Act, if people have insurance, there'll be some reimbursement mechanism for that. So presumably, if we can get this thing to work, I'm optimistic that, you know, we'll have more people who previously didn't have health care coverage that will actually be able to, there'll be some reimbursement to providers for providing that care. It won't fall on states, and there should be some more money in the system.
I'd like to say something in response to that also. One of the things that really is going on, you know, it's a person-centered healthcare system, and so the person becomes, in many ways, responsible for their own care, which is also a big order. But one of the things that we can do that's rather innovative and looking ahead is to harness technology to integrate people into providing them with information and ways they can use it, and engaging them actively in making decisions in mental health. There's a system developed by a mental health consumer, Pat Egan, called Common Ground, and it's an automated decision support system that provides a person with information that asks the person about their own goals for themselves, how this fits into their care. The information that the person puts into the system, computerized and calls the person every time, goes to the psychiatrist before medication visit. So a lot of that time that goes into, you know, answering those questions is there already. And the person, these are often people who are pretty functionally impaired, has something, a piece of paper in their hand that is their thoughts and their words that they go into. And so they can engage in some kind of conversation. So I think we really need to harness
technology. Yeah, it really is.
I think that's important.
Well, it is 10 o'clock.